stick my chin out.
It varies.
And I have something if you want.
Senate Intern Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Madam Vice Chair.
I have just a little vignette here under the chapter called Coping, and it's from the Voices of the Guard, and these are sort of poems written by soldiers and family members of the Oregon National Guard. And this is what one person submitted. And I assume that he or she was in either Iraq or Afghanistan when he or she wrote this. You have this uncontrollable sense of wanting to be in control of your entire situation. You want to know anything and everything that's going on that might relate to you in any way. So that keeps you moving and keeps you aware, and it just mentally exhausts you. But because you orient that feeling with life and death, that's what drives you. Even if that's not what you're consciously thinking, the neurons in your body are saying, keep moving. I can't allow myself to sleep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues and members of the public, and for those of you who are on the camera system out there, we have a new recording system. I hope we're coming through clear. If you don't know, the blue light special comes on later. I don't know what other interesting things will happen in the communication system, so you should be paying attention to that. We're going to go down through our schedule. We have a couple announcements from the committee administrator, and then we're going to try and go straight down our schedule. However, we are expecting one of our good colleagues from the House to pop in, and so I'll probably interrupt the schedule and move that around to accommodate her. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as to the announcements, that's correct. We have a new recording system, and that's being announced in all the committees, so it's probably gotten repetitive at this point. The blue light no longer has a flashing mode as it did previously. When it's on, it's recording. When it's off, it's not, and there is a significant delay. Often folks like to approach the dais when the meeting closes. If you could wait until that light is off, then we'll protect you, your conversation with the member that you're seeking to address. Background briefs are also ready. They've been updated. They're updated every 2 years by Committee Services. We attached a sample with instructions how to navigate to that page. Committee Services is happy to assist anybody to look at that topical information, not just on veterans, but all sorts of topics. And the concept request deadline, as most people are aware, I just want to remind you, is Monday. And that's it.
And committee members, we'll talk a little bit about concepts at the end of the meeting, which I hope to be done promptly around 3 o'clock. We are going to step out of schedule right off the bat since Representative Nathan is not here, and we're going to ask the Secretary of State staff to come forward if they would please. They're going to give a small update on the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And while we're talking about blue light specials and communications, I would remind everybody that we do have a camera, and when you're sitting down at the podium, if you lean forward to testify and you're wearing a toupee, everybody will see the toupee and nothing else. So just keep in mind the camera is above us. So
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us. My presentation is going to be very brief because
please state your name.
Oh, for the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'm just here to introduce the two auditors who worked on this report. To my immediate left is Sharon Blasey. She is the audit manager over this audit. And to her left is Elliot Shuford, who is the staff auditor who pulled a lot of the information together. So I'm going to turn it over to those two for a presentation and yield my seat to Cameron Smith, who can also talk about the audit. So
thank you very much. Please proceed.
For the record, my name is Elliot Shuford. I'm a performance auditor with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss our recently released review of the Department of Veterans Affairs. We initially started a multi-agency audit focused on the coordination of veteran services in Oregon. As part of that initial work, we interviewed a range of different stakeholders and community partners and heard a lot of real positive praise about the State Department of Veterans Affairs. I can assure you that's not always the case when we do performance audit work, but it was in in this case. We also reviewed a lot of the recent changes and efforts underway at ODVA. After our initial review, we decided not to conduct a full audit, but are issuing this report, which details a lot of the things that we did find. In particular, the report identifies some areas that we believe that the agency may wish to consider as it's refining and implementing its strategic plan. I'm going to share a few of those areas with you today. Generally, they fit into four sort of major categories. The first one is there are opportunities that the agency may wish to consider to strengthen oversight of County Veteran Service Officers, or the CVSO program. There's ways to better identify veterans and conduct outreach. Ways to continue to develop key partnerships with other agencies and service providers, and also ways to improve and expand the training that's offered by the department. As you're aware, ODVA plays a key role in coordinating veteran services in Oregon. A large component of this is the department's oversight of the CVSO, or the County Veteran Service Officer Program. ODVA, and really the state, ultimately depends on CVSOs to accomplish the important work of helping veterans access their federal VA benefits. We recognize the department is focusing on strengthening its relationship with CVSOs. And since they're county employees, that the oversight function that ODVA has is somewhat complicated. Still, our report points out a few ways that the department could consider to strengthen that oversight. They may consider developing clear performance standards for CVSOs, and they might also consider communicating those standards to those whom the CVSOs report, which I should note varies considerably from county to county. You know, in some counties, they may report directly to county elected leadership, whereas in other counties, they may sit within a county health department. So it's a very variable picture for CVSOs. The department may also wish to develop new or refine existing reporting requirements for County Veteran Service Officers as well. Federal VA data shows that relatively low percentages of Oregon veterans are accessing their federal VA benefits, as is the case in other states. You know, one of the key things that the state really needs to market those benefits or to have an opportunity to inform veterans about their benefits is the identification of veterans. So it's kind of a starting place. And the report notes a couple of areas that could be strengthened to help with that identification and outreach to veterans. Most of those strategies involve other state agencies. We found applications for state agencies, and here I'm talking about different state programs. It might be SNAP or TANF or other widely used applications. They vary with respect to what's asked about veterans' military service and veteran status. You know, a question in one instance might be, is any member of your household a veteran? Or in another, it might be, is there any VA income that you receive? We heard that many people who would likely qualify for as a veteran may not identify themselves as a veteran. So, for instance, anyone who served in active duty but may not have seen combat, they may not consider themselves to be a veteran. So that question about it, you know, asking if you're a veteran, some people may be a veteran but may not answer yes to that question. So the report notes that ODVA may wish to consider partnering with state agencies to ensure that widely used state applications contain the most appropriate question to help determine if someone is truly a veteran and eligible for federal benefits. Some agencies, per legislation, are asking members of the public about their military service and sharing the veteran referral information with ODVA. In one case, it's unclear whether ODVA can share this information directly with County Veteran Service Officers. ODVA might again wish to consider partnering to ensure that the information sharing with these agencies is effective and streamlined. Related to information sharing, ODVA, we know, is working to enhance its ability to collect and analyze data. Another tool for identifying veterans is the Public Assistance Reporting Information System, which is called PARIS for short. This is a joint federal and state program which provides states with matched data showing those veterans who are also receiving public assistance through programs like Medicaid, for instance. Some states have robust PARIS programs, which seem to have been successful in helping to ensure that veterans are getting the maximum federal benefits to which they are entitled. In some cases, this means that those veterans are able to move off of partially state-funded programs and as they access a wider array of federally funded VA programs. Those state funds are then available to help others in those state programs. Here in Oregon, DHS is starting a pilot project in some of its program areas to use the Paris data. Our report says that ODVA may wish to consider partnering with DHS and OHA to ensure that the Paris data management and the Paris pilot will help ensure that veterans are accessing or maximizing their federal VA benefits. The department has identified the use of partnerships as a key strategy in its strategic framework, which aligns with several of the considerations we outlined in our report. The department may wish to strengthen some of those existing partnerships, or in some cases may develop new ones. In the area of higher education, the department may wish to partner with the institutions of higher learning, so the colleges and universities, to help recruit new veteran students and help maximize their success. Continuing to develop or strengthening existing partnerships may also help in the marketing of veteran employment information or veteran employment programs, and may help ensure widespread awareness about services that are available to help or assist homeless veterans or those at risk of becoming homeless. Finally, training was another area for the department's consideration. In addition to helping veterans file to access their VA benefits, ODVA told us that CVSOs play an important role in their community by helping veterans access other services that are available in their community. Since this work is not currently included in the CVSO training and certification that's conducted by ODVA, the department may wish to consider including referral work and this other community-based work in their training for CVSOs. Also, we heard differing views among community partners and CVSOs about how veterans who receive state assistance through programs like Medicaid would be affected if they pursue federal VA benefits. ODVA should consider clarifying how state and federal VA benefits affect each other and then make sure to share this information and training with CVSOs. Caseworkers and other community partners may benefit from such training as well. In closing, ODVA is refining and implementing its strategic framework. During that time, we really appreciated the opportunity to provide some insights which may help veterans improve their situation here in Oregon. And with that, I thank the committee for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions about the audit that you might have.
And you're getting off scot-free, right? You're not speaking. Okay. Before we move to the director, any questions for the Secretary of State? Okay. Director Smith, you inherited all this.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I will be honest, most of my fellow colleagues, fellow agency directors, when they see Mr. Gary Blackmer and his audit team coming down the hallway, they may spin and go 180 degrees in the different direction, not wanting to be under the lens. But the way that we approach this, we have been digging in with our new team at the department, both at a management and staff level, digging into our strategic framework. So it's a great time for additional input and considerations and a welcome outside perspective that will only make us better. So we really welcome the considerations. We'll work to include them. And basically, the report and Elliot's work and Sharon's work speaks for itself and our response letter. But most often, our response is the strategic framework that we will also brief later today at the appropriate time.
Thank you. Questions, Madam Vice Chair? Senator Olson?
Mr. Smith, you've been pinned down three clicks south of State Street here by Mr. Blackmer. Have you made any improvements to the ODVA loan program?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senator Olson, excuse me. One of the original reasons our department was founded after World War II was that home loan program. Out of the housing reset, it's a big question. Yes is the short answer, but still a lot of work to do. In the depths of the recession and the housing crisis, went down to a calendar year of $4 million loans going out to veterans and their families. On pace this year to do about $40 million to $50 million in loans, which is a significant benefit both for the veterans and their families, but a critical way that we fund our operations. And we'll get a little bit into it in the strategic framework, but still a vast amount of opportunity to improve that core program that we are directly responsible for.
Thank you. Senator Courtney, any questions? The only comment I have, which I passed on to council, is I mean, I think this committee and the committee in the dungeon that, you know, counts out the few shekels we have are keenly interested in the Paris program and the ability to team with DHS and identify common areas in which we can try to get veterans' benefits first together. So at some future point, I would like the department, and I've asked council to get a hold of DHS and come back with, you know, what's your plan and how can you guys best partner using the Paris data? Obviously, we're not looking for anything earth-shattering in the next few months. With that and no further questions, thank you to the two of you from the Secretary of State's office for providing some guidance to the young Marine captain. With that, we're going to move on.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I also want to note she got off scot-free, but she is a Navy veteran herself. And between the two of them, they were at more veterans and military events and linking to our stakeholders over the year. But 14 or 15 years service.
Thank you very much.
As well as the audit expertise.
Thank you. With that, Director Smith, we're going to move on to you because we're actually waiting, still hoping that Representative Nash. Okay, good. So, Director, you're still on, and I have like four lines of you, so.
Get this up.
Yeah, we.
If we could dim the lights, too, a little bit, just for visibility. Good afternoon again, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And the way that we are framing our strategic framework that we've been developing and that we will input the Secretary of State's audit and review considerations into, we are framing it as a new cadence forward for our military families and our veterans across this state. Honoring where we've been and the strength of our department, but also the significant opportunities that we have moving forward. And we feel the significant, I don't know if it's pressure or momentum or focus, but the shared review, both out of the audit and from our own team, we are coming up on our 70th anniversary as a department next year, 2015, started after World War II, but we are now striving to serve four generations of veterans across five major wars, unprecedented in our state and nation's history. One out of every 10 Oregonians is a veteran, over 320,000 veterans across this state. And we are a large and diverse group. So these are the rough population percentages for our veterans population. World War II, 6.5% on up through Korea. Vietnam, still the largest at 37%. 25% for the humanitarian and peacetime operations in between the major conflicts. Gulf War at 15%. And while Iraq and Afghanistan, the most recent conflicts in the news, still a small segment of that population. And even just in the last year, we've lost World War II last year would have still been about 12%. So just over the last year, cut in half for our aging World War II veterans. And we are also a diverse community, so about 9% women veterans, 8% minorities, 1% we always highlight tribal veterans, serving at a higher level per capita than any other group. But for this large and diverse group across urban and rural Oregon, only 3 out of 10 veterans have accessed what are largely, the most significant, largely federal benefits. This isn't for lack of work. It is a problem across the nation. We are a top 10 state for veteran services. 71,000 claims submitted under ODVA's power of attorney in partnership with the county VSOs in fiscal year 13 and 14. And importantly, that can be additional secondary or third decisions on claims, but 16,000 new claims to make sure that we are doing the deeper dive, whether with Vietnam veterans or our most recent generation. Beyond these dollars and benefits making an impact life by life, family by family, individual by individual, a significant infusion of federal VA dollars into the pocketbooks of veterans and into the Oregon economy. So these are graphs comparing the 2013 numbers for VA dollars and 2012 numbers for federal VA. The total $2.2 billion, up by about $300 million from 2012. And this is largely across the health care, the disability compensation and pension, GI Bill, Voc Rehab, any number of different federal VA programs. Just the 2.2 is almost incomprehensible, but just in cold hard cash of compensation for disabilities and low-income pensions, $1.1 billion. So about half of that is actually cold hard cash going into veterans' pocketbooks and banks and being spent in our community. That is up a little under $200 million from 2012. Healthcare is the other biggest, $959 million spent on VA healthcare, both at the medical centers and through the clinics. If we compared these numbers going back to 2003 when we kicked off Iraq and Afghanistan, it would be about half the impact overall. So significant infusion of these federal VA dollars over the last decade. To break that out further, just on the disability compensation and pension, it's about $92 million every month for about over 60,000 veterans that qualify. And per veteran, the per capita rate is $14,000, over $14,000 as the average per capita disability compensation. So you can see quickly as we mobilize these different strategies and implement these different strategies, getting more folks drawing down this federal VA resource is quickly going to help save. It's an infusion by itself, but also saves on the back end state safety net services. So we have been digging in with our new team at a very high level. Not that we haven't had a strategic framework and been a good department with a good vision previously, but just trying to refine it and define it. So we dug in with our team on our core mission, or our core vision, our mission, and our core values. We want veterans and their families to thrive in Oregon. Our more focused mission, ODVA serves and honors veterans through our leadership, our advocacy, and our strong partnerships. So it's both about our core programs that we have direct responsibility for, like the home loan program, but also the broader leadership and what we can bring to bear to mobilize other folks. And then our core values that guide us in achieving the mission and vision, respect, integrity, stewardship, and excellence. We've been doing this brief for a lot of different partners, whether congressional liaisons, veterans community, the county veterans service officers. We could spend all day digging in one by one on these five-year goals, objectives, and strategies, but just want to highlight those big four for us are targeting veteran services, mobilizing partnerships, driving veteran engagement, and then invigorating our own core operations. And what is different, I think, in our strategic framework than previous efforts at our department, historically, we would have been very laser focused on those core programs of the Veterans Home Loan Program, the skilled nursing veterans home facilities, the conservatorship program, our claims and counseling within our lane. That is still critically important, and multiple strategies under that invigorating our own core operations. But we can do, you know, we're 80 FTE roughly, about $10 million general fund. For the breadth of the population that we are serving, for the breadth of the issues across education, healthcare, employment, housing, for us to truly have veterans and their families thriving in Oregon, we are going to have to mobilize our fellow state agencies, our community partners, the broader network. Targeting veteran services is really trying to mobilize that inverted pyramid of the federal VA, draw down more of those resources, a lot of strategies that we're implementing with the county veteran service officers, making clear distinctions. What's a statewide veteran service responsibility on training, on claims review, on advocacy, and then that boots on the ground presence through the counties, both to draw down those get power of attorney and draw down those federal VA resources, but also link to a broad network of community resources. Even if we do that lane well for veteran services, counties through the state to the feds, we have to have the broader partnerships. We've had testimony at this committee in the House veterans from community colleges, from employers, the broad network of nonprofits and other community partners that are essential. Knowing that only 3 in 10 veterans are accessing federal benefits, we can increase that, but they're also getting services from the range of stakeholders. So we are looking at a lot of strategies of how we mobilize those broader partnerships. And we are bringing you can get to a very scattered shot approach. So we are laser focusing on both health and wellness and then education and economic opportunity as the two big buckets for us to focus on. Regardless of that veteran services lane and the partnerships, we know there are more, or because of those two lanes, we know there are more resources for veterans and their families than any other citizen in Oregon. But sometimes it's simply the awareness, whether it's on the home loan program or different benefits, both at the local, state, and federal level. So making sure that we have both from the print to the online to the peer-to-peer, that we are front and center to drive that veteran engagement and be the right resource at the right time in front of the veteran and their family. And then lastly, we will not lose that focus on our core programs. We will not be able to achieve them if we aren't providing the best in care at the Oregon Veterans Homes, have re-energized the Veterans Home Loan Program and made it beyond that low income or low below market interest rate, make sure the process itself makes it a competitive product, not just that interest rate. So at that, I think I'm going to hold off and see if there's any questions, and we'll also touch on some of the other more specifics. But this is a huge opportunity for us. Irregardless of budgets and the economy, we can do more with the resources that we have. We can do more leveraging our partnerships, and it feels like an exciting time at the department and with our partners to really try to drive this work forward.
Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Mr. Olson?
Yes. Have you taken upon yourself any programs that are informative to veterans so that you can reach out to all the veterans, postcards or any kind of mailers or anything to get out to give them a list of what they might qualify for? Or do we just rely on like VSOs or other agencies?
So Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senator Olson, it is an all-hands-on-deck approach to that driving veteran engagement. Out of previous legislative sessions, ODVA was directed to have kind of an all-encompassing veterans benefit magazine and handbook. So we have both that in online and in a tangible hard copy for those that want it. But we mail those out to all of our partners. When we are getting those referral systems between DMV, BOLI, and DHS flagging, yes, I'm a veteran and interested in resources, that's one of the ways that we get that out. The CVSO network is incredibly powerful, linking to the veteran service groups, the online social media. When you Google Oregon Veterans, ODVA is that top of hit on the websites on Google search. Companies pay millions of dollars for that search optimization. We have it. So one way that we've been trying to, beyond our own, sometimes the state website designs and flavors are not always conducive to the best of design and sharing the information. So now we've started our own blog, both email subscriptions, our own blog to highlight issues, and then built out websites for those county VSOs that want it, knowing that a rural CVSO might not be able to carve out the time to create their own website, be able to leverage our content that sometimes we steal from the feds, but really a huge opportunity. We are doing a lot, but that is going to some key strategies to drive that forward are also essential.
Follow up, please.
The reason I asked that question was, as I am a veteran, and I just, when I redid my driver's license this year, I put the veteran tag on there. But to date, I've lived here for 38 years, and I've never received anything from ODVA regarding anything. So I just wondered, I mean, I see here from one of your charts that we reached 3 out of 10. That means there's a huge parcel of people out there that we can get in contact with. And so I'm just wondering if what your plans are to make that contact, because there's obviously a huge pot of money that we could continue to bring into the state if we could get those people on board.
So Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I would say it's both that referral network, whether from fellow veterans, from the service orgs, from that initial, when we do get the DD-214, when folks elect to send it to their state departments, there is no one database. We're looking at some policy option packages going forward. How do we continue to build those referral networks from both the community and our fellow state agencies, but then make sure we're catching that information in such a way that we can use it and be able to reach out to folks, and then all of the different strategies for that direct outreach. Through all the awareness efforts that we're doing, both in print and social media, about 62,000 veterans impressions per month. So it is significant. But if you ask your average veteran, do you know pick your benefit and pick your veteran group, a lot of them are not going to be aware of what is out there. So a huge opportunity going forward.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I think it's actually remarkable in hindsight that, you know, we've punched the numbers up basically since the 2005 era, $1 billion. And the actual expenditures in new cash and new programs putting in there is shekels, a few million dollars into the VSO program, and most of it's been reorganized, restructure, and work harder. But I think it's behooving on the committee in the future to figure, you know, to assist in this and figuring out, you know, how can we boot? We're gaining $300 million a biennium. How do we do it better? How do we do it faster? How do we reach more people out there?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, when I look at that CVSO structure at the local boots on the ground level, the work on that claims caseload is significant. They're not marking time down there at the local level. Significant caseload of taking those power of attorneys. We see an opportunity to invest heavily in that local infrastructure through the county VSOs, both to provide that mission, but then also have the time to be able to make these links to the different community groups and the partners to get that message out there, to get that word out there. And then combined with our statewide level, making sure they've got the training, making sure we're tracking the outcomes, doing the review. It's going to line up nicely, I think, to drive these numbers further.
Mr. Chair. Do we have any connection with our current National Guard and Reserves that they have information when these people get out of the service that they can grab a folder and walk away with it?
So Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senator Olson, it is often a challenge when folks are leaving the military and their minds on getting back home to family and friends to capture their interest, but there is a robust transition program. Night and day from 2003 to today, the worth of that program, that it is actually helpful. And for this, we've got the second largest deployment of the National Guard right now since World War II in Afghanistan right now. Very similar mission to that 2009 significant push with the Guard in Iraq. When they filter back through Fort Lewis, there'll be that formal DOD, Department of Defense, and Guard transition, but we'll also make sure that we've got our veteran service officers there specifically when they're coming back. But it is not just simply that one transition point, but sometimes it's the connections through Yellow Ribbon events, and we've got a strong partnership with the Guard. Sometimes it's that 6 months hit, year out hit, or they've got back to school but then are struggling to get into the economy and get a job. So it really is, even under the best of circumstances, it is a difficult transition out of the military, even under the best scenarios. So some critical links with the military. And for us, without that big presence of big bases like Fort Lewis or San Diego military culture, the National Guard is a huge component. We've seen their good work through the reintegration team. As the wars wind down, there is always risks that that federal DOD funding that has created a reintegration team model through the Guard itself, focused on jobs, focused on supporting them through education and reintegrating, always at risk. But I think we've had a lot of congressional support. It looks like at least through September 2015, that reintegration team model will hold steady as a partner. So as we continue to innovate at ODVA and take that mission on long term, if that federal funding goes away from the Guard for their support of their own, that is coming back to us, and we'll be ready.
Okay. Since you're at a breaking point, I'm going to ask you to indulge me for an alibi here and let Representative Nathanson come up here on the and get back on my schedule and then come back to you in about 3 or 4 minutes. Is that okay with Mr. Chair? Representative, and I believe you have Doug Toomey with you, too. Welcome to the other side. The far side, as you people say, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. A couple of months ago, I was invited to a briefing. It was held on the University of Oregon campus. I attended this briefing with Congressman DeFazio. Professor Toomey and several other members of the faculty at the university were there to describe to us their work, along with the work of some other academic professionals in institutions along the West Coast. They were describing their work in monitoring seismic and volcanic activity. When I heard about this work and the very likely relationship to an early warning system, early earthquake warning system, I felt that the information that they had was so interesting but also so compelling that I requested, and I want to thank the chair for allowing time on the agenda, I thought that the legislature should hear this information. When we think about earthquake warning, some people think about earthquake prediction. That's not what this is about. I was recently reading something that describes a situation where, for example, if you have even 30 seconds warning, a warning connected to an automated system can help do a planned system shutdown rather than a crash. For example, you can slow down a train or a light rail system. You can shut down a gas line. You can prevent some other business losses if you're able to have even just 30 seconds, much less a few minutes warning. The information was so compelling. I really wanted the legislature to hear it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Good afternoon, Chairman Boquist and committee members. I'm Douglas Toomey, a professor of geophysics at the University of Oregon. I want to thank the chair and all the members of the committee for the opportunity to submit testimony about improving monitoring of earthquake and volcanic hazards in Oregon. My colleagues and I lead research focused on seismic and volcanic activity in the Pacific Northwest, and today I will emphasize a time-sensitive opportunity for the state of Oregon to purchase National Science Foundation-owned seismometers that are currently installed in Oregon but are slated soon to move to Alaska if we don't act. Purchasing these high-quality sites will greatly enhance monitoring of earthquake and volcanic activity in Oregon. In my testimony, I'll outline the hazards of the Cascadia subduction zone, explain how a timely investment will benefit the Pacific Northwest and the state of Oregon in particular, and describe a future when an earthquake early warning system monitors the Cascadia subduction zone in real time. A magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami comparable to those that occurred in Alaska in 1964, Sumatra in 2004, Chile in 2010, and Japan in 2011 has and will again hit the Pacific Northwest. The source of this devastating earthquake will be the Cascadia subduction zone, which lies beneath the coastal areas of Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. It's been more than 300 years since the last great earthquake and tsunami, and we are in the window for recurrence. The Pacific Northwest is unprepared for a catastrophe of this scale. FEMA estimates direct financial losses would be $60 billion, while the Insurance Bureau of Canada expects losses of approximately $75 billion Canadian. In the recent Japanese earthquake, losses exceeded $210 billion. Because the Cascadia fault zone lies offshore, we do not understand it as well as onshore faults. The NSF sensors that the state has the opportunity to buy represent an important part of a larger effort to help prepare Oregon for the next big one. The University of Washington and the University of Oregon operate the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network that locates more than 1,400 earthquakes per year greater than magnitude 1 in Washington and Oregon and provides an assessment of earthquake and volcanic risk. The University of Oregon is responsible for maintaining and monitoring sensors and stations located in Oregon. In addition, the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network records seismic data that is fundamental to the research programs of many Pacific Northwest researchers. It serves science and public safety at the same time. Unfortunately, the state of Oregon has many fewer sensors than necessary, particularly in southwestern Oregon, and falls short of its neighbors in funding this vital area of public safety and research. The states of Washington and California, for example, provide approximately $600,000 and $1.2 million per year to the University of Washington and UC Berkeley Caltech, respectively. To drive home just how unprepared we are, consider the map shown to your left. This map shows seismic stations operated by the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. Observe the near absence of earthquake monitoring sites within the large red circle encompassing southwestern Oregon. If we presume that the next massive earthquake in the Cascadia subduction zone begins in the northern California and unzips to the north, then it's obvious that our current capacity to detect earthquakes in this crucial region is inadequate for protecting society. What I would like to highlight today is a unique opportunity to purchase part of an NSF array of seismometers currently installed in Oregon. The consensus of Pacific Northwest scientists who study earthquake hazards is that acquiring these seismometers is of the highest priority. Moreover, it's cost-effective to purchase these installed and operating instruments before they are demobilized and moved to another region. In 2015, the NSF array will move to a new site, most likely Alaska. However, the onshore seismometers and vaults can be purchased. These include 27 high-quality vaults. They have strong and weak motion seismometers and telemetry already installed and operating in Oregon and Washington. 15 of these sites are in Oregon, and provide enhanced coverage of the Cascadia subduction zone and volcanic arc, and those are the ones highlighted in yellow circles on the figure to your left presently. The total cost to purchase all 15 sites is $670,000, and this is effectively 50% off the original cost to purchase and install these sites. There are several advantages to buying these seismometers now. They will greatly enhance capabilities of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network in poorly covered regions of Oregon. They will contribute infrastructure to an earthquake early warning program in Oregon, and they will amplify the research capabilities and future funding opportunities of Pacific Northwest scientists. In support of my testimony, I have submitted to your committee a scientific consensus statement that is signed by prominent researchers from throughout the Pacific Northwest and Canada. These include seismologists from the University of Oregon, from Oregon State University, from the University of California, Berkeley, from the University of Washington, and the University of British Columbia. I would like to close by describing a future when an earthquake early warning system provides citizens with real-time warnings to take emergency actions. An earthquake early warning system is well suited for the impending magnitude 9 earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. This is because the most powerful earthquakes occur in a region that lies primarily offshore as opposed to directly beneath metropolitan areas. Given the immense length of this fault, if it were to begin rupturing in the south, Portland would receive as much as 3 minutes and Seattle as much as 5 minutes before severe shaking begins. Even in Eugene, Oregon, where I live, our schools, businesses, and hospitals could be warned by as much as 2 minutes before shaking starts. 2 minutes is a long time. I asked the principal of a local elementary school, which was built in 1926, how long it would take to evacuate all 350 students. The answer, a minute and a half. Only a West Coast earthquake early warning system could provide advanced warnings that will save lives, protect businesses, and facilitate a more rapid recovery for local communities, the state and federal governments, and the economy as a whole. An investment now by the state of Oregon that purchases the NSF seismometers currently installed will not only improve current monitoring of earthquake and volcanic hazards, it will contribute infrastructure that supports earthquake early warning, and it will help position the Universities of Oregon and Oregon State University for future federal investments. I thank the chair and all the members of the committee for their leadership in allowing me to testify. Thank you.
Vice Chair?
What department would have jurisdiction over this at the state level?
Jurisdiction over these seismometers?
Over siting, over early. Putting them in the ground,
I just want to clarify. Jurisdiction over the seismometers currently installed that would be operating in the future or over the earthquake early warning system?
No, well, probably both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Chair Boquist, Senator Moens. The Pacific Northwest Seismic Network is funded by the U.S. Geological Survey.
Okay.
So together, the University of Washington and the University of Oregon receive funds from the USGS to operate the PNSM. Those sites are installed both on public and private land, and we work with those stakeholders to get the permits and install the sites. The 15 sites currently installed by the National Science Foundation are operated by the National Science Foundation through a consortium called IRIS. They've also gone through various stakeholders to get permission to install those sites. In the future, when federal funding, and I think it's a win, when it arrives for earthquake early warning on the West Coast, that will be operated by the Advanced National Seismic System funded by the USGS. The academic communities will provide warnings to the public, and the public and private sector will use those to notify both the civilian population but also infrastructure.
I'm a little confused. Follow up then.
Yes.
I know that Representative Nathanson said that the state should purchase these, but then you're saying that the feds have money, and I'm just not clear as to what the money from the feds, why couldn't they be helping us put these in?
Chair Book with Senator Mullins, there is an effort that's not yet funded to provide an earthquake early warning system for the West Coast.
But not funded. That was the key.
But not funded.
Okay.
All right.
And I'd also like to add that by purchasing these seismometers now, it places both the University of Oregon and Oregon State University in a stronger position within the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. We have been, to a large degree, underfunded for quite a long time in Oregon for seismic monitoring. So many of the stations that exist in the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network are primarily in the Washington state. And by purchasing these 15 seismometers, it allows us to come to this game with more infrastructure and play a more solid role in future build-outs.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
Senator Olson?
Oh, you have a follow-up, madam?
No.
Senator
Olson?
Hey, Courtney? I have a couple questions. First, if you would, Representative, so that I can put clarity to everybody sitting out there behind the camera here. So what we're really, what Representative Nathanson has brought forward, and I'm assuming is down at Joint Ways and Means or the E-Board or whatever we call it these days, is we're trying to come up with support to for the University of Oregon, am I correct here, to purchase 15 of these. Who is going to be the purchaser of the equipment if it goes forward? And then correct me if I'm wrong, what you did say is the operational maintenance cost is probably grant money through USGS to operate it. Am I correct, sir?
Chair Boquist, yes. So the state would provide the funds to purchase the seismometers. They would those funds would somehow come to the University of Oregon. Right. We would pay the National Science Foundation for those 15 installed sites. They would become part of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, and their operations and maintenance would be through grants to support that network.
And to follow up, to make sure I understand, are we, because I've done a little bit of research here, just so in the background, so I'm trying to make sure at least the public understands here. The purchase, the $800,000, is basically the price tag that National Science Foundation has put on them, right?
Chair Boquist, the price tag for those 15 seismometers is $670,000. That includes the purchase and installation. What we pay for to the National Science Foundation is for the hardware itself. We get the installation for free.
Right.
That's effectively doubles the cost of if we had to go out and buy those 15 sensors and install them ourselves.
And I guess one final question, and then I'll let the representative make her pitch again here, what's the scientific or political reason that the National Science Foundation is abandoning us?
Chair Boquist, I don't think they're abandoning us. They actually maybe stepped into the breach for a few years. I run the Cascadia Initiative, which is a four-year onshore-offshore experiment to take a look at the Cascadia subduction zone. And the facilities that support the onshore and offshore component of that experiment were funded by stimulus funds. And that facility moves on to a new site to conduct more science in the future, and that's going to be Alaska. So I don't think they view it as abandoning. They view it as they provided a shot in the arm to scientific studies in the Pacific Northwest, and that research facility will move on to a new location in the near future.
So in short, they came in and helped fill our breach, and now they've realized that, okay, they got to go someplace else.
Correct.
Okay. I'm going to look for nods in the audience back here because I want to make sure there's coordination. I'm certain that none of this is news to emergency management in the state. They're familiar with this. And then the other thing I want to just throw out here, and I'll look for the deer in the headlight look. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, it used to be hard here. I'm assuming you're familiar with the Oregon Resilience Plan and the Oregon Resilience Task Force, and so that I want to make sure everybody's coordinating here. So if we're going to do something, that everybody's on board and kind of working together so everybody's familiar with what we're doing.
Yeah, can I add something to that? Chair Boquist, to a large extent, this opportunity and the federal ask for earthquake early warning is allowing OEM, DAGAMI, and the universities to communicate more frequently and work together.
Okay, good. Because, unfortunately, this is the doom and gloom committee, and so we're quite familiar with the Cascadia fault line and everything that's going to go south on us instantaneously or near instantaneously, as you pointed out. Representative, if you had something else you wanted to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The points have been made. I wanted to emphasize that the issue is the seismometers that were installed for more like a basic research purpose, can be now transitioned into an operational purpose rather than simply scientific research. It can be something useful for us. I also wanted to mention that, yes, there are several state agencies that are involved, aware, and I have had an initial high-level discussion, you know, just very brief, with the Director of Office of Emergency Management. They are aware. There are conversations happening back and forth about what would be involved, what would this mean.
So, Representative, where are we right now in the process?
In the process is I have made my interest in this acquisition known to my Ways and Means co-chair, meaning on the House side. I've also had an initial conversation with the Legislative Fiscal Office to help understand what the options might be for funding. Is this a capital thing? Is this a more of an ongoing budget reconciliation or e-board request? What is the right avenue or what is the right mechanism for funding? So I've had initial conversations along those lines, and we're still talking about it. They're aware that the opportunity exists. My concern is that we have enough of a conversation at the legislature, even if it means perhaps a letter of intent or something, to make sure that whatever process is going on at the national level or the federal level doesn't go so fast that we don't have time to act. I don't want us to fail. I don't want us to lose out on this opportunity just because we didn't act in a timely fashion. If someone is already starting to think ahead about a schedule for contracting to remove this equipment from the ground and transport it to some other state, I'd like to slow down that process until we can consider it here at the legislature.
Is there a decommission date?
Yes, possibly as early as April, May.
Mm-hmm.
So less than a year.
Less than a year. Because the intriguing part about it is I mean, we would like to make everything earthquake-proof, but if you can, those you can't earthquake-proof, if you can evacuate people in a timely manner, it makes the...
it doesn't make Cascadia palatable. It makes the situation better.
Correct. Yes, and if I might add one more point. Earthquake-proof for physical structures is great. I'm also concerned that we initiate work. I would very much like to be in a position to afford to initiate work on automated systems that can start to shut down those things that need to be shut down, where there will be additional hazards posed. If you have gas lines still flowing, for example, if you have airports or transit systems where some sort of electronic communication could have started to either slow down or stop something, it would be important for the private sector as well as the public sector if we can have a more graceful shutdown of systems rather than sudden emergency crashes of systems and then what happens subsequent to that. And one of the great dangers is, of course, fire.
Death and destruction, unfortunately. Right. Thank you very much. Anything else, Doc?
No, thank you.
We appreciate the update, and I guess we'll hear more from you. Thank you. Thank you
very much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Director, you're on again. We're waiting.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record again, Cameron Smith with ODBA. Just to wrap on our strategic framework portion and the annual report update, a lot that we can be proud of in the last year. So encourage you all to, if we haven't gotten you a copy up at the of the annual report for the accomplishments over the last year, both across our team and with the broader partners like the counties. And we look forward to working with you forward as we bring some policy and budget proposals that we think help achieve. Still, we are taking the hill for our veterans, but still a lot of targeted initiatives that we can move forward as we head towards the 2015 session. Want to continue on?
You have the three next dash marks. I don't know how you're organizing these, but they're yours.
So, Chair Boquist, on the suicide prevention, wanted to see if we could call up Dwight Holton, CEO of Lions for Life, in addition, both to hear from him. I will not go into details so heavily on the suicide, the facts that we face in suicide, but whereas Oregon veterans are only 1 in 10 of the population, we're about 23% of all suicides across Oregon. While it's not been a spike, but it's been consistently disproportionately high. And through the leadership of the legislature, we were able to have a contract to bring and develop a public-private partnership on a military veterans crisis line. I want to hand over to Dwight for some of the details on that effort.
Thank you very much, Director, Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is Dwight Holton, and I have the distinct honor of, for the last 6 months, being the CEO of Lions for Life. For those of you who know my predecessor, all of you, they're the biggest tiny shoes to fill. but Judy and I have been working very closely together. She sends her regards.
I'll bet you don't wear slippers.
I do not wear, I do not wear heels. I cannot manage it, I assure you. We are thrilled to be up and running with the Veterans Crisis Line that's supported by the state and by the legislature and by with the great help of the ODVA. The snowballing growth of our volume underscores the need for this vital service. Our volume has nearly doubled since the state launched the Veterans Crisis Line. Our volume of veterans-related calls on the military helpline on the Veterans Suicide Crisis Line, and we've seen it increasing steadily since we launched the program with the state. We're up 25% over the first quarter when we began the program. The growth is a direct yes, Chair?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Vice Chair.
Vice Chair.
When you say it's doubled, I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking? Tens or hundreds?
In the last quarter, we had 434 calls on the Veterans Suicide Crisis Line, up from 337 the quarter before.
Thank you.
So we're seeing not just and that's doubled over last year. We had a military helpline before that had been kind of plugging along and unadvertised and unpromoted, but available. We've seen that double to the 434 in the second quarter, and at 25% growth over the first quarter. And the growth is really a direct result of the outreach effort that have been made possible by the state. We've had both an aggressive broadcast media advertising campaign. In May, we unveiled a new military helpline PSA, broadcast PSA, that we were able to put together in partnership with KPTV, but it's been on networks across the state, including the launch was during the Blazers playoff run, which was really terrific. It was amazing to watch the volume on the website spike as the ad ran. We've also complemented this with a aggressive radio broadcasting campaign. In June alone, we had over 5,000 radio spots run on AM and FM radio throughout Oregon, reaches rural Oregon, where most of our vets live, of course. And that's another example of tremendous partnership with the private sector. The Oregon Broadcasters Association gave us essentially a 75-to-1 return on our ad buy for those ads. So it's been tremendously successful. We've also had a really aggressive boots-on-the-ground outreach effort in rural Oregon. We were trying to figure out how best to capture this for you, and I was talking to we had six people who divided up the state and have been kind of aggressively doing trips out around the state to American Legion halls and sheriff's offices and libraries and schools and community colleges. And I just grabbed the sheaf of notes from one of the trips of one of our folks from last weekend. You know, I looked at their kind of weekly schedule, and they were actually in your jurisdiction for part of it. This is from May, Senator Boquist, Chair Boquist. And, you know, there are 53 different locations that Andrea hit that week. That kind of effort is what's helping drive this volume. We're very pleased with the fact that the reality is what this means is we're reaching more and more of our veterans in need and helping them find that way forward. You know, behind all of these numbers are real people, real stories. One of our regular callers, most of the calls, close to 90%, are from new callers each time. One of our regular callers, though, is a guy who lost both of his sons within about 12 months. He had been in recovery himself from drug and alcohol abuse for many years. He relapsed in June and subsequently reached out to us, and we're now kind of his go-to for getting through the next day. He's back in recovery and hopeful he can make it through, but that's the kind of call that happens every day when you go back to the call center. We'd love to have any of you come visit us and see it. I know some of you have been there already. It's really remarkable what they do. Most of the calls are frankly answered by
volunteers working with supervisors, and there we try our best to have the calls answered peer-to-peer, which is really a tremendously important way to reach people. We very much appreciate the partnership with the state and with the excellent work of Director Smith.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, one additional piece. So that was an appropriation that enabled that this work out of the 2013 session. Another bill that came through this committee with this leadership, Senate Bill 762, directed a suicide prevention and outreach program, a veteran suicide prevention and outreach program, to be staffed up by ODVA. The initial work was simply getting the funding streams aligned, both through the charitable checkoff program and also now when Oregonians go to re-register or register online at DMV for registering their vehicle, a little blurb pops up, would you like to donate to veteran suicide prevention efforts, that now link over to our donation page. From ODVA, we've always focused on donations to the veterans' homes, now including a women veterans bucket, a veteran suicide prevention bucket, and then a catch-all veteran service bucket as well for donations. Those have raised about a little over $13,000 to date, so that will begin to tee out into not just what they are able, Alliance for Life is able to market and outreach on that awareness, but also make sure that the federal VA and the military helpline at the national level is fully seeded out there to key areas and key demographics for our veteran community. And one nice link across those two efforts, when you call that National Veterans Crisis Line or the National Military Crisis Line, if you're calling from Oregon, those do bump to Alliance for Life, so another good connection there. And when that call center nationally gets overwhelmed, Alliance for Life is one of those regional call centers that helps take on that additional volume.
And that happens every day. The VA call volume has dramatically increased in the last 4 weeks. We used to get 180 calls a week or so, sometimes 200. We're getting close to 500 a week now. And
in the last 4 weeks.
It started right in the beginning of August. And I haven't found a good answer for what the volume is being driven by. This is from the VA line. Canandaiga, New York, they have a center. They take about 7,000 calls a week. Every day, as you get over their capacity, it comes out to the six regional centers. All six of us are taking those additional 200-300 calls a week. And it's not an ad campaign, but boy, I'd hire the marketing firm that could pull that off, right? A tripling of our volume. But it's not. They're not doing any special advertising. It may be tensions arising around the brutality of ISIS and the military action.
Psychology.
But something's going on. Initially they said, oh, it's Robin Williams. And, when Robin Williams committed suicide, we did have a spike on the non-military line. It lasted 2 or 3 days and then went away. It was great. There were great calls. It was family members who were worried about family members. It was a great way to reach people. But this is something different, and we just don't have a good answer for what it is yet. The only thing I would add is one of the things we bring to the table in having a partnership with a nonprofit is we can bring private partners in to help. Les Schwab, for example, a tremendous partner of ours, not only did they put the military helpline advertisement PSA in their rotation on the Blazers games, basically one out of every four ad spots they buy goes to us, but they've also helped with our boots on the ground effort, and there are nearly 200 showrooms around the state are all going to have advertising materials for the Veterans Suicide Crisis Line. That's the kind of thing we can help do from the outside, and we really appreciate the opportunity to do it.
Next line item.
Thanks, Dwight.
Thank you. Thank you for your good work.
Next up, an update on the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Healthcare, and I'll ask Eric Belt, our Administrator for Veteran Services, to join me. We had a lot of task force model out of former Governor Kulongoski's era, focused on broad supports for veterans. This one was a legislatively directed task force in 2010, focused on women veterans and then specifically focused on women veterans. And I believe Senator Mona Sanderson served on that task force and remembers it well. As an opening before handing over to Eric to kind of brief on some, much of these recommendations are largely federal VA healthcare system recommendations. Still a lot that we can talk about in our own lane to better serve women veterans for health and all matter of needs. But a lot of the recommendations were to the federal VA, and that's what will be the update. But overall, over 28,000 veterans, women veterans in Oregon, about 9% of the veterans population here in the state. And where we see, 320,000 total strong. We're a decreasing population as we lose the large populations of World War II and Korea. But one of the fastest growing demographics of the veterans population is women. Over the next 20, 30 years, that number will bump up to about 20% of the veterans population. And historically underserved, both within the Department of Defense and the military, and from the VA community. So a lot of good opportunities to serve this growing demographic of veterans. And I'll hand over to Eric.
Please.
You said that we have, what percentage of the military now are women, of the military?
Chair,
you say
there
are 9% veterans.
I'd have to double check on the percentage of the military, but I believe for active and guard and reserve components, it would be about the same percentage.
9%?
But I'd have to, about 9%. I wouldn't say over 15%.
Okay, thank you.
By any stretch.
That's what I wanted to know.
It's changing. This week, Special Operations opened the doors for women combat pilots.
Really?
In 160th Special Operations. So those boots that aren't on the ground in Afghanistan or in Iraq now, the boots, the 1,200 boots that aren't on the ground but are in Iraq, right? Those now will include, you know, women combat pilots. But their boots aren't on the ground.
But Special Operations do include women.
Yeah,
just now they're adding to
the combat air wing. Combat air wing of boots that are not on the ground but are actually in Iraq.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Belt. I am the administrator of the Veteran Services Division for ODVA. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update to the VA predominantly and ODVA is providing in support of the specific needs of women veterans. The federal VA has taken steps to address this growing need for health care specific to the needs of women veterans through a variety of initiatives that I will outline for you today. While not specifically connected to the recommendations of the 2010 Task Force on Women's Veterans Health Care, they do address many of the concerns that were raised in the report. Number one, in 2010, the Portland VA Medical Center opened one of the nation's first women veterans clinics. The center also provides mental health care, social work support for women veterans, and the number of female veterans using the facility has grown substantially since 2010. Within that first year of 2010, they served about 400 female veterans. That since has risen to 1,500. According to VISN 20's 2013 annual report, as of February 2014, more than 80% of all women within the catchment area are now receiving comprehensive primary care from designated women's health care providers. This is one of the highest rates in the nation. Three of our facilities within that catchment area, not Oregon specific, but Puget Sound and then Roseburg and White City in Oregon, currently provide comprehensive care to over 90% of female patients. So higher than average within the VA system. In 2013, VISN 20 purchased maternity care for over 460 women veterans, an increase of 53% over the last 5 years. Portland VA Women's Clinic also provides gynecology, urology, so that women have a one-stop shop type of model of care. Within the Portland VA Medical Center, they now have a MST coordinator, a military sexual trauma coordinator, specific to the women's clinic in the hospital. They also have a specific specialized trained sexual trauma counselors in the Salem Vet Center as well as the Portland Vet Center. And each of Oregon's VA clinics, the CBOX, the community-based outpatient clinics, have designated women health care providers who are trained and proficient in providing women's health care to female veterans near their place of residence if the woman prefers. And women are invited to choose their preferred gender of their provider when they enroll in VA health care. According to the Portland VAMC Women's Veterans Manager Coordinator, Nancy Sloan, conferences have also been designed to train community providers in treatment options for MST and have organized and had good participation in the years since they've placed an emphasis on that in 2013 and 2014. There also is a national PTSD website, and there is a military sexual trauma support team. The Military Sexual Trauma Support Team is an initiative designed to support national monitoring of MST screening and treatment and to expand MST-related education and training, also to promote best practices in the field. In addition to serving as a point of contact for questions from the field, the MST support team hosts monthly educational calls that are open to all VA staff, an annual multi-day training for MST coordinators, and annual events in honor of Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April. Another major educational initiative that the federal VA has pursued has been the establishment of a MST resource homepage, an intranet webpage that serves as a clearinghouse for a variety of MST-related resources, including patient outreach materials, provider training opportunities, discussion forums, and descriptions of VA policies and benefits related to MST. Also, the Department of Veteran Affairs has launched a new hotline recently, the 1-855-VA-WOMEN, W-O-M-E-N, to receive and respond to questions from veterans, their families, and caregivers, and to many of the VA services and resources that are available specifically to women veterans. And this hotline is staffed by knowledgeable VA employees who can provide information about those benefits. The VA in Portland has also established a women veterans program manager that previously the was held just by the women veterans healthcare coordinator. So they've also increased their staff in regard to oversight within the state of Oregon and also within the catchment area within VISN 20. So subject to your questions, that concludes my summary of VA Women Veterans.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, just simply big VA, the federal VA, has stepped up, but a lot of these initiatives are still centered around the Portland VA Medical Center and their surrounding clinics. Yesterday on the House side, we heard more of the gap. Generally, women are an underserved veterans population on health care and other needs, but especially across rural Oregon, whether the smaller medical centers in Walla Walla, Boise, Roseburg, that we do feed into, not as robust an effort as we see out of Pill Hill and Portland VA Medical Center. So they have stepped up significantly, but still a lot of work to come.
Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember when we first started this process, and it was abysmal what was being offered for women. Women have not been treated fairly or equally in the VA. And so I think this is, even though we still have a very long way to go, this is an excellent step in the right direction. And the fact you went from 500 to 1,500 being seen at the clinic on Pill Hill, it's to me that's impressive because we're starting to meet the needs of many of our women veterans. Thank you.
Any, aren't they still working on the clinic and the satellite clinic here in Salem?
So the Chair Boquist, members of the committee, it's been a game changer to get out of the major medical center model and put this care in the community, both through purchase care where they don't have the specialists, but from those clinics, the CBOC model. They have rolled out across the state, and as they have rolled out and as demand has increased from the broad segment they're serving, they have had to increase in size. So now the Salem Clinic has recently reopened a much larger facility. I mean, it's gone from kind of a broom closet 10 years ago to an amazing clinic today. A little bit of a difficult place for transit in the local Salem community where it's located down
McGilchrist.
McGilchrist, thank you. But if you haven't been, it is a gorgeous facility. And to have that as a front line and make sure, even for folks in the valley, to not have to haul, much less folks from Bend or the coast or across rural Oregon. It's been significant.
Senator Courtney, anything? Nope. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric.
You have Veterans Home, it says here.
And a quick update on Veterans Home, pending any questions. We've had the long-term facility since the 90s, 150-bed skilled nursing facility in the Dalles. We've always been on this U.S. News World Report Best Nursing Homes publication list, second year in a row, one of the top-rated nursing homes in Oregon. But just this year, we're awarded the Gold Excellence in Quality Award from the American Healthcare Association and the National Center for Assisted Living. Some of these award programs, they sprinkle broadly, get impacts broadly, but this has only been given out 24 times since it began in 1996, and is really both a commitment to performance, a commitment to quality outcomes, and that process improvement. Simply amazing outcomes that they are delivering, and it's ODVA's Veterans Home, but in partnership with professional management from WestCare and the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon. First Veterans Home in the nation to receive this Gold Award, and a significant statement of the outcomes that we're delivering. Also want to highlight, we submitted in 2008 for our second home up to the federal VA. Finally, 6 years later, coming to the dedication this Saturday down in Lebanon for the second facility. Less of the institutional wing model and more of the small home community-based living model. Going to be one of the, it is the newest facility in the state, but will be one of the best rolling forward. Had our flag dedication with the Veteran Service Orgs this Monday, and this Saturday at 11, we'll dedicate that facility to begin to expand that service for our aging veterans.
And how many veterans will that serve?
Roughly 150 again.
Questions, members? Are you out of oxygen now, Mr.
One
Director?
Last comment.
Okay.
The legislature did ask that we do a larger review of skilled nursing needs for veterans, and we'll have a more in-depth report that we'll work with the committee staff to see if we can present back in December, looking at the dynamics of not just through veterans homes, but how are we better serving veterans through all of our facilities across the state.
Okay. And we look forward to your update in 3 to 6 months in regards to the Secretary of State's comments.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Thank you for all the good work you do on behalf of our veterans. We're going to move to a quick update on House Bill 2417. Mr. Fisher and Allison McIntosh back there. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. It's great to be here. Thank you for an opportunity to give you an update on the implementation of House Bill 2417, which created an ongoing dedicated revenue source for veterans to support stable housing. Just to quickly remind you about what the bill did and why we did it, one of the things that really jumped out is that veterans who are 18 to 30 years old are twice as likely to be to experience homelessness as their peers the same age that did not serve. And that's an unacceptable reality. And so this bill was aimed to provide housing supports across the housing continuum to make housing more available and stable for veterans. The way that the revenue is collected is through document recording fee. It was built onto an existing document recording fee so that we weren't building new systems. We wanted it to be something that we could add on to something that was already in place so that it could be, the funds could go directly to veterans. The three buckets, if you will, of where the funds are being used, again, go across the housing continuum. So you have home ownership and efforts to try to make home ownership more achievable for veterans, affordable rental housing, and then also serving veterans that are either at risk of homelessness or experiencing homelessness. I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about that last bucket, the homelessness and homelessness prevention bucket, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide association of community action agencies, and they are community-based organizations with expertise in helping with housing stability. To date, this is the first money that is actually hitting the ground. So the first allocation was dispersed to local communities in July, 1st of July, and we already have some reports on how that money is being used. Much of it is being used to leverage the SSVF grants, the Social Service or Supportive Service for Veteran Families grants. These are federal grants that have some restrictions in terms of how they can be used. One of the most difficult restrictions is the income level, which is a very low income level. The source of funding that we have created has a little bit higher level. So whereas the SSVF grants are able to serve some veterans, it's not able to serve all veterans. And so this is able to help fill in some of those gaps for folks that come in that don't meet that SSVF criteria. We're also seeing this money be used to leverage the VASH voucher program, and it can be used for things like deposit, emergency rent assistance, getting a credit report or an application fee, some of the soft costs that go with trying to get into rental housing, which the VASH vouchers do not cover. Once you get in, they'll pay for the rent or all but a third of your income for the rent, but they won't cover those other costs, and sometimes that can be the barrier. So I just want to say that from the stakeholders' perspective, I also work with the Oregon Housing Authorities, which were very supportive of this bill and initially came up with the proposal. We feel like the agency has done a very good job of reaching out not just to our organizations but to other housing stakeholders and veteran organizations to get our input about how best to implement these programs. And again, they've done a good job of adding on to programs that are already there, so they're not having to reinvent new administrative systems to disperse the funding. But it's a very efficient way of reaching veterans through community-based organizations. One of the great things that's come out of this is that there have been more conversations between organizations like ODVA and community-based organizations that I work with about how do we reach veterans. They're coming into our doors, and now we're getting links to the CBSO, and we're continuing to try to build those connections, and it ties in very much to what Director Smith was talking about with their strategic goals. So, you know, we hope to be able to come back in the future and give more updates. The thing is that right now, we're very excited that this is getting started. We see a bright future, and happy to answer any questions.
Allison.
Thank you. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. The agency I work for provides stable and affordable housing and engages leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and opportunity for Oregonians. In 2013, when House Bill 2417 passed, it added an additional $5 to an already existing document recording fee to help ensure veterans have a safe place to call home. The original document recording fee was passed in 2009, and the funds created by that fee, as well as the additional money for veterans, goes to Oregon Housing and Community Services, and it's divided by percentage for the following uses. 10% goes to the emergency housing account to prevent it and homelessness. 14% goes to the homeownership account to ensure affordable homeownership options, and 76% goes to the general housing account for affordable housing development. So House Bill 2417, as Ryan said, went into effect on January 1st. The money comes from the counties a quarter at a time, so to date we've gotten 6 months' worth of collections, and we've collected nearly $1.4 million in funding for veterans. Those collections are down slightly from projections, but we believe this may be cyclical, and we're watching it closely. Since the passage of the bill, HCS has been working to determine the best uses of funds, and in particular, as Ryan said, to ensure that these funds are using existing partners or programs to increase capacity to serve veterans. We've been talking closely with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and County Veterans Service Officers, as well as housing providers that have expertise in serving veterans, to ensure that we're meeting the most pressing needs of veterans in our communities. The first ones went out the door on July 1st through the emergency housing account, and to date we've distributed about $140,000. Those funds are divided by formula and go to community action agencies across the state, as Ryan described. The other two pots of funds are currently accumulating so that we can roll them out with enough dollars to really make an impact. For the homeownership program, we've accumulated just over $194,000, and we're considering three uses for those funds. The first would be down payment assistance for veterans, either through nonprofit housing providers or through the OR Vet loan. Last year, ODVA funded 32 loans that would have met our program income criteria. The second would be mortgage payment assistance for returning veterans who are un- or underemployed and are having difficulty making mortgage payments. We have a pretty successful program at OHCS that we're modeling this after and are working to figure out the delivery system. And then the third possibility would be adaptability. We know some veterans have homes that need to be adapted to continue to be accessible to them after an injury or a disability. And we have partners across the state who currently do great work to add ramps or grab bars, widened doorways, or other critical health and safety repairs. And then lastly, we're still thinking about the development of affordable housing. To date, we've received just over $1 million, and we're talking with partners about the best ways to serve veterans with this type of housing, and are considering two possibilities. One would be a model where we develop smaller projects with 6, 8, or 10 units with services combined to really help veterans be stable in that housing. Or another model would be a larger development where there are units set aside for veterans in the development. As you know, developing affordable housing can require some significant capital funds, so these will be the last funds to go out the door. In the meantime, we're continuing to see increased partnerships between service and housing providers, the County Veterans Services Service Officers and the VA system, as well as ODVA. And we know that our partners are starting to learn more about CVSOs and the VA system, how to better serve veterans that are already living in their housing, and how to make sure that the veterans are receiving benefits that they're entitled to. And lastly, I just want to mention we're actually convening the Rules Advisory Committee tomorrow, and we'll be discussing the last pieces of implementing the homeownership dollars, and we'll continue discussing how the affordable rental housing dollars will go out the door. And that committee includes representatives from ODVA, the federal VA, CVSOs, and housing organizations that serve veterans. Thank you so much for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Courtney. Leverage and coordination. I mean, we've got to make the dollars go as far as we possibly can go.
Absolutely.
And we, you know, coordination and cooperation is the key thing. I think you heard the same thing. We've made a $1 billion gain over at ODVA in the CVSOs and pouring in state funds coming into this thing. But there's a long ways to go. We all learn new things. I've just earlier in this briefing, or earlier in the meeting, good counsel talked about the background brief for veterans, which, if you don't know, is one of 90 reports that are generated by committee services. And ironically, even us legislators can learn, because I was in a meeting with 8 of my fellow legislators earlier today, and only 2 of us knew these even existed, and all of us are senior members. Mm-hmm. Not junior freshmen or first-termers.
I didn't know either. Mm-hmm.
And so even we in the legislature got to learn to coordinate better and use our resources better amongst ourselves. And that's the key thing that's out there. And I think that was the goal when we decided we were going to bite the bullet and do this, is to be able to have those seed funds to plug them into the places to get things started. So I appreciate both of you doing the good work, and thank you for the update.
Thank you.
With that, we have one major item left on our agenda on your back page, colleagues, which is an update on ORS 408-237. I'm going to ask Coloma Sparks, Lori Skillman, and Andy Smith to come up, if you would, please, and give us an update. And then we're going to do a 30-second update after that amongst ourselves, and then we'll go from there. And I'm guessing that I don't know who's going to lead off. Lori, are you leading off?
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I've asked her to pass out our report. I know that you have it electronically. This is a report of 13 stakeholders that were involved in the Veterans Preference and Employment Work Group. I am just presenting on behalf of those stakeholders. They're all listed at the top of the report. The stakeholders are a broad cross-section of city, county, and state agencies and representatives, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, city and county associations, Oregon Military Department, and the Employment Department. And I'll just refer to that group as stakeholders in this presentation. Let me start with the absolute agreement among every member of the work group, including all stakeholders. All members of the work group agree that veterans' preference laws are valuable and important because these laws recognize and honor veterans for their sacrifice and service. Veterans' preference laws give special consideration to veterans in a competitive hiring process. And all members of the work group agree that veterans are valued employees because of their rigorous training, specialized training, leadership skills, sense of teamwork, and their ability to learn new skills. The stakeholder group did come to consensus that maintaining the status quo on Oregon's veterans preference law is not working for veterans and is not working for public employers. I think it's helpful to frame the issues as what's the problem that we're trying to address, what are the challenges within the existing statute, and what does the stakeholder group believe that this, why does the stakeholder group believe that the status quo is not an appropriate course of action? First, if you read the statute, you will find quickly that there's a lack of definitions on real key terminology, and the definitions that do exist are challenging to read and understand. The legislative intent in the statute is not stated in the statute, and to try to parse out the legislative intent out of the statute is a challenge. So I would suggest that the legislative intent is not clear. The lack of clarity in the statute and the lack of intent has created honest and fundamental disagreements about the meaning, interpretation, legislative intent, and the application of the law. In the statute, there are no clear methods for how an employer should apply veterans' preference. There is no uniform method established, and it's extraordinarily difficult for the employers to implement. The lack of clarity in the statutes also creates a great deal of confusion for veterans. The statutes themselves are a real challenge just to read and get through. And finally, the lack what happened in 2011 was there was a House Bill 3207 that created ORS 408-237, and in that piece of the Veterans Preference Statutes, it addresses interviews and transferable military skills. The focus of that statute is on those two things. That statute was kind of just added into the Veterans Preference Statutes. Consequently, it doesn't mesh well with the other parts of the statute. They're internally inconsistent with each other. And the net result of all of that is that the Veterans Preference Statutes have led to a significant amount of litigation in the cities, counties, state of Oregon, and other public employers that are listed as public employers under the definition. Maintaining the status quo is not going to resolve those issues. One of the other issues in the statutes is that when you have large candidate pools and unclear interview requirements, it makes it a real challenge for public employers. For entry-level positions in large public employers, there may be up to 400 applicants that are qualified for that particular job. If there's an interpretation that you must interview every qualified veteran, and there may be up to 75 veterans, that's a real challenge to manage. And it is also, on a practical level, it's unclear whether interviewing all qualified veterans is truly in the best interest of veterans. If there are 75 qualified veterans for positions and 300 non-qualified veterans, how the interpretation of the statute requiring each veteran to be given a veteran, how is that meaningful and beneficial to a veteran? The requirement may require unnecessary sacrifice for those veterans. They have to take time for their current job. They may have to travel someplace to go to those interviews. And it may give a veteran a false hope about a job opportunity. Typically, when you are asked to come to an interview, that means you have a real shot at the job. And I'm not sure that that message is clear if 75 other veterans are being interviewed for that one entry-level position. To most people, an invitation, let me kind of step back a minute and talk about how the stakeholders approached the work that they wanted to do. They came up with some guiding principles. What is it that's really important? First, they believe that the statutes must be very clear and use plain language. Second, they want in the statute clear and uniform methods for applying veterans' preference laws. So all public employers are using the same methodology, and they're applying it uniformly. Third, they believe that focusing on the number of veterans given initial interviews and on the veterans' transferable skills is really important. As I said, that House Bill 3207 that created 408-237, that particular statute focused on giving more veterans interviews and transferable military skills. And the focus on the interviews was because it's a challenge to translate military skills to civilian work skills. And providing that initial interview would give the veteran an opportunity to describe those transferable skills and would also give the employer an opportunity to engage with a veteran and truly understand and appreciate what those military skills were and how they work in that particular position. And finally, we felt it was really important to integrate both pieces of the statute so that there was a cohesive, clear statute. And finally, one of the things that the stakeholders wanted to do was to provide this committee with what the important public policy considerations are in veterans' preference in employment. The stakeholders also believe that it's really important to place the legislative intent and the policy into the statute so that it's clear for everyone. So here are some of the policy considerations. One, should veterans' preference statutes use plain language and should they be easily understood by public employers, veterans, and the public? Should the methods used by employers for applying veterans' preference be clearly stated in the statute? Should public employers make hiring decisions based on the results of a merit-based competitive process that includes looking at ability, skills, knowledge, experience, and other skills? Should we define veterans' preference as a uniform method by which a public employer gives special consideration to a qualified veteran and additional consideration to disabled veterans within the context of that competitive hiring process? Should the method for applying veterans' statutes be structured in a way as to give special consideration and greater opportunities to be selected for a first interview to veterans during that initial phase of that hiring process? And should it be fair to veterans, applicants, and reasonable for employers to implement and provide employers with a little flexibility in designing specific hiring processes? Should every veteran who qualifies for a position be granted an interview? Should the legislative intent be clear and stated in the statute? And finally, I'd ask the committee, the stakeholder group would like to recommend to the committee that the stakeholder group be given some additional time to more fully develop concepts and provide the committee with some clear, thoughtful, carefully considered methodology for applying the statutes, some clear policy considerations for the committee, and some alternatives for the committee to consider. We would like to come back to the committee and report back during December legislative days, if the committee so chooses, and present a more comprehensive report. Thank you so much.
Andy?
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Andy Smith, and I work for the Association of Oregon Counties, and I provide staff support for veterans-related work, and this is a new committee for AOC. We've done it with about the last year. It is a dedicated policy committee that would stand right along with our other big committees, whether they be land use or public safety. So the profile for veterans is definitely changing in the AOC world. But that part of it has changed, but since 2005 and even farther back than that, counties have been kind of the front lines for the benefits that CVS, that veterans and their families receive. We are the employees of CVSOs that I'm sure you know about, that work very closely with the state, and it's a great partnership we have with the state. So we view ourselves, counties, as very much as advocates for veterans, and in fact we're very proud of that increase, and you've probably heard about it before, but in 2007 it was $600 million in disability and compensation, and then 2013 it was 1.1, so it's up across the state. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars are flowing into our communities. So in that part of our work, you know, it, we're clearly the advocate for veterans, but it is a reality in the workplace. We're the employer, and we're trying to implement the statute. And so I think as part of this work group, the conclusions I've come to is that we all have the same intention in terms of the all of the partners at the table are really all veterans advocates. What we've run into is a law that the mechanics of the law, the implementation, pretty much don't work. And if I was summarizing that, I'd say it's because it's a confusing statute. There are different interpretations. And then beyond that, it's not just confusing, it's not working. So, I mean, are we getting more interviews for vets, and does that lead for more jobs for vets? I don't think so. I think it's created poor results both for counties who want to help but are frustrated, but then, of course, for veterans and impacted family members, we aren't achieving the goal of, it's not just interviews, obviously it's the job. We haven't gotten there yet. So I think my message today, the takeaway, welcome, Senator Courtney. The takeaway would be we're working on a fix for legislation to give veterans a better shot at employment, and as part of that is the interview process, so their military experience can be translated. So we have a statute on the books that tried to do that. It's not working, and I think that was a consensus of the work group. But we haven't figured out a solution. So we would like to come back in December, would echo the earlier testimony that with more time, I think we can give you concrete legislative proposals, maybe a look, what would a new statute look like? I don't know if it would be amending what we have. It might be looking at some other states that have taken a run at this a little bit differently. Same concept, same ideas, but how we do it may be a little different, but we don't have that product for you today is kind of the message, but we'd like to come back and do that for you.
Paloma.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The mission of the Bureau of Labor and Industries is to protect employment rights, advance employment opportunities, and protect access to housing and public places free from discrimination. This includes protecting veterans' rights in hiring and employment. BOLI is committed to ensuring that veterans have a fair and meaningful shot at a job while providing clarity to employers seeking to navigate Oregon's law. We were assigned to lead the work group. We worked with the Department of Administrative Services, Department of Veterans Affairs, various local and state other stakeholders. We continue to work on trying to figure out the best way to make any changes to the law. We worked early on, discussed about some definitional changes that might help provide clarity to some of the public employers. We also talked about ways to integrate the statutes that some folks felt was confusing. As the workroom continued on, there became some difference of opinion about whether or not the veterans preference was intended to apply to just get you to the one interview or if it applied throughout the process. BOLI's position is that if it's only to get you to the initial interview, then that could potentially lead to some abuse or some complicated issues where you could have a pro forma interview that wasn't really a meaningful preference in that way. We also feel that the law was intended to make sure that all qualified veterans were given an opportunity to meet face-to-face and talk about transferable skills. If we change that, I think that there would also have to be some more significant changes to figure out how transferable skills could be communicated prior to the interview then. We feel strongly as an agency dedicated to protecting the rights of veterans that the veterans' preference should not be scaled back to change either existing protection. We believe that veterans who've served our country have tremendous talents to offer our state and stand ready to protect their rights while providing support and clarity for Oregon's employers, including our other agency partners. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Madam Vice Chair, any questions? Senator Courtney? Any other? Okay. So that House bill came over here in 2011 to our side, and I guess I'll take responsibility because ironically I mentioned earlier that six of eight of us in a legislators meeting this morning didn't have any idea we did background stuff, right? The other story of the takeaway is there is we had the same two-hour meeting yesterday, and you would think in this building these four words we would all agree on. The first thing that came out of this eight group of us trying to, with consultants to figure everything out, was what is joint? there were 8 different definitions of what a joint committee is in that room. And we think that would be that simple. And then we even got to the word bipartisan. So I hear loud and clear from you there is a lack of clear definitions in the statutes. I got that. There's a lack of clarity. We're kind of running forward to a few deadlines. We're going to, you know, put placeholders in place at this committee level to fix whatever was however it came across the first time, in outlining that we're going to have veterans' preferences. So we're going to have 2 bills. So yes, I'll invite all 3 of you back in December so that we do that. The one thing about clarity is that I do want to provide clarity about is that both chambers since 2005 have been a nonpartisan effort to help veterans. And in 2005, I think we started out then and we heard, you know, one of the very first groups we heard was problems with veterans hiring, how are veterans treating, how are veterans treated when they're deployed. And for those of you who employers support the Guard program is, I mean, several of us were deeply involved in that in reviewing what was happening to deployed soldiers, reservists as they go out. 99% of every problem that went by the first complaint was because a public agency screwed over a veteran or screwed over a deployed soldier. The businesses found out what it is they were supposed to do by the law, and we had one problem after that. And the state agencies were the absolute worst. The first ones to come really, to come that had any problems that said we're going to fix it were the counties. And my hats are off to the counties. The counties have created a committee. We still have the veterans preference problem. We have resolved most of a veteran. If a soldier deploys here in the National Guard or the Reserve in this state and a state agency goes after it, they will get tarred and feathered by the public. It's just fact of life now, 12 years later. But we still have the same veterans preference problem we had in 2005. So we're going to go into this next session and we're going to fix it. And it might not be to the best liking because we have an existing law. So yes, please take the time to see if you can work out what's going to come out. Because as you point out on your page, we have an existing law. And unless it's clarified and there's unanimity and we all agree how to clarify it, there's going to be more litigation. And the litigation is veterans suing public agencies. So I guess what we're going to end up doing is if we don't have some clarity by December, is the very first thing that's going to happen, regardless of who's in charge of veteran security come January, is there's going to be a work group. And there'll be people invited. And if this is the chair here and I have to invite you by an invitation you cannot refuse, then that's what we'll do. But we've been at this since 2005. And we still don't have it right. And you're right. We got to fix it. Thank you. Colleagues, we have one item left. Cheyenne's going to run down the list, or Council's going to run down the list very quickly of some of the bills that we have that either members or legislative concepts are putting forward. And I remind every member, if you've got a concept, we need to get it in. And this is a nonpartisan committee, so it doesn't matter what your concept is. We need to get in and get it drafted if we want the committee to consider it in December. Council, if you would please run down the list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and an excellent segue. The Senate Veterans Committee has authorized, in recognition of some of the division and the efforts the parties have put into this, the problem with the job interview statute, a couple of committee bills to see what alternatives can be come up with. One is in the hands of Boley and the others is in the hands of the remaining members of that stakeholder work group. Senate Vets has also authorized a redraft, you'll remember, from 2013 of Senate Bill 1505. That's the one that excludes a veteran's disability income from calculations of spousal support in domestic relations actions. Representative Huffman, I'm also aware, is working on a concept, member concept, to designate highways in Oregon as veterans' memorial highways, and I believe Senator Monders Anderson is working on one for jurisdictional statutes for veterans' courts, and those are the ones that I know of right now that pertain to veterans.
Do you have others?
Well, besides the veterans' treatment courts, I have also submitted for draft a monetary ask for the Oregon Military Museum that is located at Camp Withicum.
Senator Courtney, any bills?
I don't think so here.
Okay. And again, I remind members and member staff It's a nonpartisan committee here. If we have a legislative council draft we want the committee to sponsor, we need to get it put forward. Council needs to have it by Monday, right?
Monday's the deadline.
The deadline, right?
To meet the pre-session filing.
To meet the pre-session filing. So anything that you bring forward, we need to get it moving now so that we can look at it and consider it in the future. Madam Vice Chair, anything else? Mr. President? Thank you very much. See everybody in December. We're adjourned. Thank you very much. See everybody in December.